Where do these cubbins live, did you say?
Raby Beg, upper Raby Beg.
Mm.
You, do you know the road going past Raby?
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the opposite side, there's another lane going up.
Mm, I know.
Well, that goes up the Quarterland between the two Rabies, you see, Raby Beg and Raby Moor. So, these cubbins had the top part of Raby Beg for generations. And I've been speaking about Thomas Cubbin. That was one of the sons of the old lady who lived there. John, the second son, went to America. He'd be about 16 or 17 or something to me at the time. And when he was in the early 20s, gold was discovered out in California. But there was no way across the continent at that time. The only way to get was around Cape Horn, through the stormy seas and the big ships, and contact wasn't very good with the other side. So some people had got through, but he was in a party, a big party that got together to try an overland route across America from the Mississippi right across to California. And recently there was a talk about, they called the 49ers, it was in the year 1849, and that party is still referred to as the 49ers. And recently on the radio, there was a story about them, and it mentioned the names of some of them, and John Cubbin's name was mentioned among them. Anyhow, he did fairly well there, but not as well as he wanted. Mining was too uncertain. So he went down to South America to see if he could start a ranch down there, and he didn't care for that very much. And then he tried Australia, and he heard of New Zealand. And he bought a cargo of horses in Australia, shipped them across to New Zealand, sold them, did pretty well. And then he bought land there, quite a big area in South Island. And he was farming there right up to the time when the New Zealand government became a bit more civilized, and they wanted this for settlers. So they took a lot of the land from and cut it up into parts for the settlers who would come. Quite big big plots of land, of course, not trifles. And he retired. His descendants are still there. One of them is coming here on a holiday this summer, a young lady. That'll be his great-great-granddaughter. And his family's reputation are pretty well alive there still. He had some wonderful experiences there. He, with two others, they were exploring. And he left the others and went into the bush just from them for a moment. And when he came back, only their bodies were there. They'd been killed by the Maoris. And he was lucky he escaped, because he just left the others for a moment.
Mm.
Another time, one of the party that he was with dropped a lighted match and started a bushfire. And they had to run, got on horseback and away out into a lake. Just the horses' necks and the men themselves above water. And they had to stay there and that way until the fire died out around about the edge of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that he was sorry for the birds, because they never learned to fly, the birds that were around there, a particular variety of bird. And they came into the water too to try to get away from the fire, and they couldn't fly, and they were drowned in the water. They were all wiped out in that particular area. Now that's so much for the Cubbins.
Where have you got these stories about him from? Are they connections of yours?
Yes.
Mm.
I give a history of it to Mona Douglas, and she printed an article in the, published it in the Times in, what year would it be? Not so very long ago, about 20, 30 years ago. You know Mona Douglas, don't you?
Oh, yes.
So, it's still in the Times. I've had a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And I also had a letter from New Zealand showing the history of John Cubbin, very much abridged,
mm-hmm.
because it was a banker out there who was a banksman, had heard of John Cubbin and had met him.
The common characters were numerous in connection
with raising funds, you see, for poor relief, the church did try to get concerts and events of that nature organised. And on one occasion there was a concert party at Derby, giving a concert, and there was a few rowdies assembled. They used to come from south of the Peru there, from Ramig and places round about, to these purposely for the sake of making trouble, just like they do at football matches now. And there was one night at the concert, this gang were a nuisance, and they were somewhere at the, not quite the back of the hall, but fairly well back. The concert took place in the school, and the chairman asked them two or three times to have a little bit of respect and help the people who were going to so much trouble to get this event up. They were taking no notice. So he said, well, there's only one thing to do. If you can't behave yourselves, you'll have to be put out. So there's one big bully there. And he said, oh, put out, will we? There's not a man in front of me who'll put me out, he said. And there was a chap sitting two or three seats behind him. My gosh, he said, if he's not in front of thee, he's behind thee. Mm-hmm. And he grabbed him by the collar of the coat and the seat of the pants and lifted him up over his head, carried him out, over the heads of the people who were in the way, took him out onto the road and threw him over the road, scores of yards over the road. So the other gang was silent after that lot.
Mm.
I seen one rowdy gang making trouble of the sort at a concert at Patrick. But they were frightened of the law at that time. But it was, in the case of this chap at Derby, the strong arm was the only law they knew anything about.
Mm.
And again at Derby, there's another incident that might be of some little interest to you. New schoolmaster came there, and the young people in particular, and the old people too, there was generally a party meeting at the smithy, because that's the place where the farmers came to have their plough irons repointed, and especially when the ground was dry and wearing them down pretty quickly, hot dry weather in the spring when they had to get on to work, the plough irons, the socks and the coltress would wear down. Over to the smithy to get a bit of steel put on the point of them. And as usual on a hot day, of course there'd be remarks about the weather. And one person said, "Man, it was hot today. I wonder how far away is the sun," he said. This heat is coming from the sun today. How far is it?" And the schoolmaster was there that night. "Oh," he says, "I can tell you that." This new English schoolmaster. "I can tell you that," he said. "It's so many millions of miles away," and he gave the figures. And old Jimmy Kenich was sitting on the hob. And he just looked at him, he says, "Was it thee that was up there howling the other end of the measuring tape?" So, schoolmaster was squashed for sure off anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
And
that would be often the situation.
Oh, yes. There was a man living up the Glenrushen Road, not so very far from Glenmay, maybe half a mile out. I've seen the tall town is still there, as a matter of fact. And in the fishing season, when it comes to about the middle of September or so, when the herring is finished, when the shoals leave this side of the island, they go around Douglas side. It's called the back fishing then.
Mm.
I don't know why, but this old chap, they didn't get their stock when the fishing was off field, because herring wasn't too plentiful that summer. And he was out late one night. Anyhow, they did the thrashing with flails, and the flail was made up of two parts, two sticks you might call it, although they were longer than a walking stick, well, the short arm would be about the length of a walking stick, and they were joined together at the joint by a nice soft piece of sheepskin, and they were taking good care of that piece, because it wasn't often they could find a piece so pliable. And in the winter time, when the thrashing was in the spring when the thrashing was done, this was taken off the flail sticks and put put into the herring barrel to preserve it until the next threshing season. And this chap was drunk and he came home and he wanted a herring done on the old roaster, which was a wire frame in front of the fire hanging in one of the bars. You may have seen one in the museum. So he went to the herring barrel, drunk as he was, and put his hand in, took something out that he thought was there, and put it on the roaster, and did it nicely, to his way of thinking, put it on a plate, started eating, and he was nipping a piece off with his fingers. He was finding it hard to get the piece off, although it was roasted so well. And he tried two or three times, and then he had a look at it, and he saw where it was. But before that, he said, while he was trying it, he was saying, "Then skillin' a brick, ray custa. These back herrings, they're cussed tough." And then he looked out and saw where it was. It was the cab of the cab souse that was the flail.
Mm.
So
was it the curing of it that made the skin pliable, or was the certain part of the sheepskin, do you think?
Perhaps both.
Mm.
But they wanted a nice pliable bit to fasten the two parts together. About the same time.
What was the handle of the flail called?
The soust was the complete flail,
yeah.
And the cab was the thong that was fastening the two parts together.
Mm.
So just the cab soust was the flail. The soust was the flail,
mm.
And the cab soust was this bit of thong. So the cab soust was what he was trying to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now one of these cabins, he was home for a holiday. And he was in the smithy one night, there was John, it was. And he was very modest fellow, he wouldn't talk about this exploration in America, getting across the country and attacked by Indians, and attacked by yellow fever. A lot of the party died out before they got across. But he was talking about it, and about the time it took, and how far it was, and the weeks they spent over it, because they saw that the supply of grain wasn't going to last them for the journey when they were part of the way, so they halted, ploughed a bit of land that looked likely, and sowed some of their grain in that, and then they had to wait for the harvest, which was fairly soon afterwards there. And talking about all this and the smithy, men were drawing it out of him really, because he was modest, he never said anything in the way of boasting. And there was an old chap sitting there on the hob, and he was telling about the time it took and the distance it was. And he was getting a bit jealous because there was so little made of the Isle of Man in comparison with North America, you see. So he looked at me and he says, "It's there so far, is it?" And that went a long way. The Isle of Man is a middling big place too. Whether ever at Kirkmichael? "No," he said, "I never got that far." "No, and whether ever at Craignish?" "No, even Craignish," he said, "I never got there." You see, I went away when I was about 16 or 17, and I never had time to get around the island very much. So, well, don't think I'm home here telling us about America being bigger than the Isle of Man, because the Isle of Man is a middling big place. So, now, we're talking about the church, about the meeting in the school, to arrange for getting funds for the poor relief. I'm old Captain Kirkus, chairman, and parishioners are there from different parts of the parish. And the church bell started to ring. Sir John Knight, the sexton, was in the school with him. He was one of the people who were assembled, and he went out to see who was ringing the church bell. Not a soul in sight. Went back again. Went out again, because the bell started to ring. Still nobody seen about. So he went out the next time and he saw one of the goats. He kept goats in the churchyard. One of his goats standing near the bell rope, and he went up closer and he saw that she was fastened by the horns to the bell rope. Somebody was playing the trick, you see, you tied the goat to the bell rope. So when she saw Knight coming, she stood quiet. And as soon as he was gone again, she started to struggle to get away. And each time, as soon as he was gone, the bell started ringing. He got frightened because he began to think something spookish about it.
Mm.
They found out who it was that did it afterwards. And so a couple of men who were in the habit of practical jokes and pranks of all kinds. And
it would have been rather alarming at the time.
Oh yes, yes, yes. They were wondering what was doing because he couldn't see anybody. There was nobody, as a matter of fact. There was only his goats there.
Of course, the goat would stand still when he came along.
Yes,
and
yes, 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 yes. Now,
this is what sort of concerts would they have? Would they have fiddlers and that sort of
thing? Yes.
The king on the fiddle.
And speeches. Lots of speeches. There were some very good public speakers in the island in those days.
The towns would be in the Isle of Man then, it wouldn't have gone away to such a large extent in the country places.
Very likely. This is about the father of a man, an old man, in the neighbourhood still, so I don't know if you can please yourself whether it's to go in or not. There's a young fella, he was the father of boy at the time. They were living in a place called Arrasy near Glenmay, and he was always in mischief when he was coming into the village. So his uncle thought he would cure him, and he got a copy of the form that the coroners used at that time for making a summons, summon anybody to the court. And the coroners had these forms, and then they filled in, you see, you're hereby summoned to attend a court to be holden at. And then there'll be a blank for Peel Courthouse or Douglas Courthouse, yeah, wherever it was. Or, and there'll be a blank for the date and another blank for the time. Right. So when he had it finished, it read, you are hereby summoned to attend a court to be holding at Tinmill Hill on Saturday, such and such a date, at 7:30 in the evening. And he never showed it to his people at home or anybody, but he slunk over to St. John's quietly. And when he got there, there was no court being held, which the people who were playing the trick on him knew. Mm. And after a while, he had to come back again. But he didn't know that one or two of the other young fellows in the neighbourhood had been sent over to see if he was there. So he was never in any trouble afterwards.
Settled
him, did it? Oh, cured him. Mm. Mm. I could tell you which is, but perhaps
I'd better not.
There's a good trick played on a Wesleyan minister. This was at Foxdale. He thought that he would be a little bit patronising when he was going around visiting the people, and he went to one house and he said to the old, this is up in Foxdale, he said to the old man, I understand, Mr. So-and-so, that you have a language of your own in the Isle of Man. Oh, I would love to learn some Manx, and I'll try it on my landlady when I go back to Peel. Now, what should I say? What would be something I could say to her that would take her by surprise when I see it in Manx when I go in the house? So the old grandma said, well, when they get back to Peel and go in the house, say this to the old woman you're lodging with. Go around the jowl. You know what that means? So on the way back, he was going over St. John's Road, round by Patrick into Peel, met the vicar, Vicar Kinraid. And he looked at him, he said, go round the jowl, vicar. Vicar stared at him, stood and stared at him. So he tried it on somebody else at Patrick Corner, old Joe Moore. Tried it on Joe. So Joe said something back to him. He knew it was meant to be offensive, but he of course he didn't understand what it was. And then when he got home to Peel, where he was lodged in Church Street, he tried on the one Mrs. Carter's he was lodged with. What are you saying? She said. I'm saying good evening to you in your own language. That's not good evening, she said. I don't like to tell you what it is. But ultimately she did tell him, and he got the shock of his life. But he saw how he'd been fooled.
He didn't know the Manx people then.
No, indeed. Now, you believe in ghosts?
I don't disbelieve in them.
No, I believe in them because I saw one. But
Can we hear about that?
I don't know.
That would be very good. I'd like to hear that.
Would you?
Yeah.
Well, I was coming home very late from Peel one night. I lived out in the country, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Saw a man coming on the roadside towards me. I was on a push bike, he crossed in front of me. And back on the other side. And I couldn't understand how it was so silent. Not a sound heard, not a footstep heard. Now, and he was going as fast as but as I was going on a push bike. But I heard afterwards others had seen it, and as a matter of fact, I knew who it was, but he's got relatives, so I won't mention him.
How was he dressed? Could you tell
me? No, it was in the night. I couldn't
tell. Darkness?
Dark. Not particularly dark.
Were you very alone?
No, he was dressed dark anyway, which everybody was.
What effect did it have on you? Could you feel it was something?
Well, I couldn't understand. I was puzzled. That was just how it was. And then when I got in the house and I was having a meal before going to bed, late at night, about 1 o'clock or so, always when I came in late, I was going around scrounging on the cupboards, and it occurred to me then what it was.
Mm. Which part of the road was this?
Between Glenmay and Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And has it been seen within recent years?
I've heard that others have seen this.
Within recent?
Well, this would be about 1905, round about.
And did the man have any sort of misfortune when he died, or did he die naturally, or
well,
was there any reason for it without mentioning any names?
Yes, if I even told you that, it would identify him, you see, so I'd better not. But two aunts of mine saw a ghost one night.
You can tell me when we're not recorded.
Hmm.
Two friends.
Aren't you recording now?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Two aunts of mine saw a ghost one night.
Really?
Over there, yes. There, one before they got home afterwards, and they had far to go, just about the distance of a field. One of them was ill, and the other one had to get us sitting on the barn steps for a while before going in the house for fear she'd faint. The shock of seeing it.
What did they see?
Hmm?
What did they see?
There's a man, too, which wasn't a real man.
Curious, isn't it?
I heard a sign one night. Well, more than one, really.
What sort of sign? A death sign?
Yes, it was. There was an old man dying, and another chap and myself, we went to the house to sit with him because we knew that his wife was getting pretty well worn out. And when we were there, it was not very comfortable in the bedroom. It was a bit coldish. I went down to the kitchen and sat by the fire, and the other fellow was in the bedroom. And we're taking it and turning about, you see.
Mm.
So I heard some singing outside. Well, I was wondering what it was. And I never said anything about anybody. But sometime afterwards, he was talking, we were talking about signs, and he said, remember the night when so-and-so died, some nights before so-and-so died? I said, yes. Well, he said, I heard singing that night. Outside. And I said, so did I. And we weren't in the same room, but we both heard it.
Mm-hmm.
Two of us. Now, Richard Quirk at Draby was telling me, one of his tenants there in what's called Ward's House, that's a house near Draby, but belonged to the farm. One of his tenants was an old man named Christian, and he was dying. And Richard was there, just like I was there. And the wife and he were sitting with the old man. He didn't last a big long time after maybe 2 days. And he said the old man looked towards the foot of the bed and he started to smile. Ambrose, he said, Ambrose. And the wife says, what Ambrose? Ambrose left us years ago, a long time ago. Ambrose is there, he said. Pointed to where he was staring at the foot of the bed.
Mm.
And you ever hear of this chap who used to write lessons at Manx here in Peel? It was an English name, but he was a Manx.
Goodwin?
Goodwin. He wrote about a few that he knew about. And one that he wrote about was about a man living in Cowley Terrace, I think it was. And he was in the habit, late at night, before going to bed, going out to the gable of the terrace, by the high road, you feel. The road is there, and the terrace joins at the right angles.
Mm.
So, he was crushed by a crowd. He was standing there at the gate, and a crowd squeezed him, and a crowd going past on the road. Having heard, just saw them, and squeezed by them. And he had a daughter staying in the Diamond King's, a maid, that's down at Michael.
Mm-hmm.
And the Diamond King was buried out in Peel Cemetery. So she was the maid there when the Diamond King died, and this crowd that squeezed this man was the funeral going past the Peel Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
Diamond Kings. You've heard of the Diamond King, have you?
Oh, yes.
Marquise. Aye. Yes. So Goodwin records that.
What about the fairies? Did there were any fairy stories?
Never fairies in my time.
No.
No. People talk about fairies, they're always laughed at.
Yeah.
I knew a man who used to talk about seeing the fairies, but...
You think he really did?
I don't know. He wasn't a liar.
No.
Still nobody believed him in my time.
No.
No.
Well, a lot of these stories that Sophia Morrison has, they must have been around Peel.
Yes, oh yes, yes, yes.
They would
yes,
be well known.
You got her booklet, have you?
Oh yes.
Yes. Now, I tell you one thing. There's one ghost I should tell you about. There was a man named Clark living at Gordon. That's near Glenmay, you see.
Mm.
And he had a friend in Glenrushen, Willie Curran. And he was out at Curran's one night. Just those names are recorded.
Yes.
I shouldn't mention names. Anyhow, I'll not mention them.
I cannot convey anything to the
Glenrushen. He was going home, and when he was about a little more than halfway into Glenmay, it's quite a distance from Glenrushen to Glenmay, a mile and a half and one, but a man joined him, started talking to him, and he knew him, a man who died years before, his own father-in-law. So when they got near Glenmay, of course he left him again, disappeared, just as like he appeared. Cecil Cash must remember this too. And then he was ill for 2 or 3 weeks afterwards with the shock.
Yeah, most weird experience, wasn't it?
I should think it is a weird feeling.
Mm.
I have heard of others too, but I don't know how true they'd be, you see, so I just ignore them. I'm not absolutely satisfied that the stories were true.
But these you are. You do feel that these are true.
Oh, yes. It doesn't do to interfere with these ancient burial places.
Mm.
You know, Vicar and Wardens, they started messing down in the old church at Beale in St. Peter's.
Mm-hmm.
Those Wardens were all dead except one within a very short time after.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And that's not so long ago, but
no.
All dead quite a short time after. And one or two of the commissioners who were doing the work for them, the same applied to them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the men who was working on the job died suddenly while the job was in progress.
Did any of them survive?
Some of the commissioners survived.
Mm.
But
the thing you hear of.
Hmm? One of the wardens survived, but he was ill ever after, as long as he lived.
Of course.
And the vicar, of course, he was more or less an invalid for years after, until he died. And that place is left open now. Dogs and children are in, dogs and in particular in Mecklenburg.
Curious arrangement.
Mm. It is a curious. And now you'll see. When
some interesting old stones there.
Mm. When you're passing there now, you'll see builders' rubbish in.
Well, that should be stopped.
No, well, nobody takes it up. Let me see.